after such an entertaining talk, I do hesitate to bore you with something serious like poetry. No, it was very informative, and I'm extremely grateful to Max for stepping in. I was absolutely horrified when Martin was called to, was it India or Nepal? India, I believe, to see his 103-year-old aunt. I didn't think he could have invented an excuse like that. I want to start by reading you an unpublished poem I tracked down in the Sassoon manuscripts, which were recently acquired by Cambridge University Library, with the help, I may add, of that excellent institution, the Siegfried Sassoon Fellowship. It's a very exciting collection. It's the last remaining manuscripts and documents that were kept by the family. And I hadn't seen some of them when I went back to Cambridge University Library. But I had come across a reference in that other biographer's book on Sassoon, Max Egremond, and I was absolutely intrigued to find that at a crucial point in his development, he'd written 7 poems which were not published. Unfortunately, Max's reference was wrong, so I spent a week looking in the wrong book, but I did eventually track them down, and to my amazement, the media have shown great interest in this, not because I don't think Sassoon's worth it, but because I think that Sassoon has written poems that are just as good, if not better. But of course, it has to be unpublished to interest media, doesn't it? I'll read it to you. Oh, happy heart, I watch you ride, clothed in your destiny of pride, and sworn to the fair knighthood for which the names of legends stood. All courage, worthy to be sung, dreams in your face forever young, and shining thought that keeps you glad is glory won from Galahad. You and the winds ride out together, your company the world's great weather, the clouds your plume, the glittering sky a host of swords in harmony with the whole loveliness of light flung forth to lead you through the fight. This sonnet, contained in Sassoon's 1916 trench diary, is clearly dated January 1915. So it's in 1916, but January the 15th. But if I had been asked to guess when it was written, it's stirring Arthurian references linking fighting with nobility and chivalry would have persuaded me to place it earlier, that is, before he went out to France with the 1st Battalion of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and saw frontline conditions for himself. For in England, far away from the grim realities of war, it had been relatively easy for someone as idealistic as Sassoon to regard war as a glorious sacrifice, an undertaking along the lines of Rupert Brooke's 1914 sonnet, The Dead. And I do love Brooke. I feel I oughtn't to love him quite so much, but I do love him. And I think he's a fine poet as well. Blow out you bugles over the rich dead. There's none of these so lonely and poor of old, but dying has made us rarer gifts than gold. These laid the world away, poured out the red sweet wine of youth, gave up the years to be of work and joy, and that unhoped serene that men call age, and those who would have been, their sons they gave, their immortality. Blow, bugles, blow. They brought us for our dearth, holiness lacked so long, and love and pain. Honour has come back as a king to earth, and paid his subjects with a royal wage, and nobleness walks in our ways again. And we have come into our heritage, quite a far cry from what he was to write in that last fragment that he left as he was sailing towards Gallipoli, looking at the men on the ship and thinking they're all going to die, probably. Between April and September 1915, Sassoon had himself written a poem reminiscent of Brooke's rallying cry, a poem called Absolution, which forms a startling contrast to his later bitter anti-war satires. The anguish of the earth absolves our eyes, till beauty shines in all that we can see. War is our scourge, yet war has made us wise, and fighting for our freedom, we are free. Horror of wounds, and anger at the foe, and loss of things desired, all these must pass. We are the happy legion, for we know time's but a golden wind that shakes the grass. There was an hour when we were loath to part from life we longed to share no less than others. Now, having claimed this heritage of heart, what need we more, my comrades and my brothers? Well, like Brooks, these are rousing sentiments, but as Sassoon subsequently realized, they are, quote, in his words, two nobly worded lines for what he encountered when he got to France. Looked at more closely, the language is somewhat inflated, rather cliched, and certainly rhetorical. It suggests that Sassoon's response by mid-1915 was still largely unconsidered and untested, the conventional reaction of a member of the ruling classes. Some might even say it was gung-ho. Sassoon later described them as typical of the self-glorifying feelings of a young man about to go to the front for the first time. Yet the mood is not so very different, you notice, from the poem, the elevated tone of that poem I started with, Glory, 1916. Looking back on my own analysis of Sassoon's development from idealistic, self-sacrificial fervor to bitter criticism of the war, I realized that in my haste to trace its path, I probably exaggerated the straightness of the trajectory. I was a little too ready to agree with the popular view that once in France, he rarely looked back. I mean, it is rather a tempting, because simplified version of what actually happened. But of course, I mustn't now go to the opposite extreme. Of course, it's clear that his attitude changed as he experienced war for himself. Take, for example, the poem he drafted in late 1915. He went out at the end of November 1915 to France and had his first tour of trench duty at the end of November, beginning of December. It's a poem that he drafted after this experience called The Redeemer. With its insistence on unpleasant trench details, which of course had been hitherto unknown to him, it does mark the beginning of a very different kind of war poetry. I'll read you just the first and the last verse. Darkness. The rain sluiced down, the mire was deep, it was past 12 o'clock on a midwinter night, when peaceful folk in beds lay snug asleep. There, with much work to do before the night, we lugged our clay-sucked boots as best we might along the trench. Sometimes a bullet sang, and droning shells burst with a hollow bang. We were soaked, chilled, and wretched, everyone. Darkness, the distant wink of a huge gun. And here is the last verse. Having seen a British soldier, one of his men, struggling along the trench with a heavy load, he faced me, reeling in his weariness, shouldering his load of planks so hard to bear. I say that he was Christ, who wrought to bless all groping things with freedom bright as air, and with his mercy washed and made them fair. Then the flame sank, and all grew black as pitch, while we began to struggle along the ditch, and someone flung his burden in the muck, mumbling, "Oh, Christ Almighty, now I'm stuck." Of course, anticipating another couple of years of men stuck in the trenches. In strong contrast to Absolution, The Anguish of the Earth, this was completed only 2 months previously in England. This is a work full of concrete details of frontline conditions, even down to the echo of the language used by the soldiers there. I do wonder sometimes how he got his poems past the censor. The blasphemy at the end is deliberately shocking, of course, and anticipates what would become a familiar device in his war satires, a hard-hitting, deeply ironic last line. It's significant that The Redeemer was started the day that Sassoon met the poet Robert Graves, and you've heard a little about Graves, who's very entertaining, but not always, I feel, strictly accurate. Graves distrusted any attempt to sublimate feelings about the war, as Brooke had sometimes done. Brooke had sublimated his feelings. And he seemed to want Graves, in Sassoon's words, to make it appear even uglier than it was. He deliberately shocked his venerable sire, Sassoon told a friend, with violent French lyrics about lice and corruption. Sassoon's realism in The Redeemer may be noticeably less shocking than the poem you've just heard read, The Dead Boche, but it was undoubtedly influenced by him and marked a distinct change of direction. Now, all of this is just before he writes the poem I opened with, Glory 1916. So, only a little over a month later, he can still write that poem, Glory 1916, and the other six poems I dug up from January and February 1916, as well as published ones written during the same period. Some of them are very lyrical, many of them pastoral. Indeed, it is in February 1916 that he pens another Brooke-like piece, this time to his younger brother Hamo, who had died of wounds received in Gallipoli in November 1915. Again, the tone is elevated, quite divorced from the mire and the muck of the Redeemer, which it nevertheless follows chronologically. To my brother. Give me your hand, my brother. Search my face. Look in these eyes, lest I should think of shame. For we have made an end of all things base. We are returning by the road we came. Your lot is with the ghosts of soldiers dead, and I am in the field where men must fight. But in the gloom I see your laureled head, and through your victory I shall win the fight. He's still finding it possible, it seems, even in the face of his own brother's death, to ignore the horrors of war, devoting himself during this period to more metaphysical poems which deal, for instance, with the possibility of his own death, or his love of colours return to me, colours that were my joy. His retrospective comment on the type of poetry that he was writing was, I used to persuade myself that I had, quote, found peace in this new life. Obviously, the implied comment is, and I haven't. But once back at the front, from a rest period between the lines, his realization of what war means, particularly for the less privileged private soldiers, returns, resulting in the first real satire on the war in February 1916, the deceptively simple In the Pink. In the Pink is a colloquial phrase for in the pink of health, a phrase Sassoon had apparently noted in his job of censoring his men's letters. You know, they have to go through men's letters. The men would say, I'm in the pink. So Davis wrote, this leaves me in the pink, then scrawled his name, your loving sweetheart, William, with crosses for a hug. He'd had a drink of rum and tea, and though the barn was chilly, for once his blood ran warm. He had pay to spend. Winter was passing. Soon the year would mend. But he couldn't sleep that night. Stiff in the dark, he groaned and thought of Sundays at the farm, and how he'd go as cheerful as a lark in his best suit to wander arm in arm with brown-eyed Gwen and whisper in her ear the simple, silly things she liked to hear. And then he thought, tomorrow night we trudge up to the trenches, and my boots are rotten. 5 miles of stodgy clay and freezing sludge, and everything but wretchedness forgotten. Tonight he's in the pink, but soon he'll die. And still the war goes on. He don't know why. Here already is the foundation of a formula for Sassoon's bitter war satires. The verse form is simple, with no pyrotechnics to distract from the content. And the six-line stanza ends with a rhyming couplet to drive home its ironic point. The language is also simple, I suppose partly to reflect the simple nature of the soldier and his working-class background, but also to express more bluntly the nastiness of war. The phrase in the pink, which is used three times in all, ironically underlines the fact, of course, the soldier is not in the pink of health. And even if he were, it would be short-lived. His boots are, frankly, rotten, not politely inadequate. And as the narrator concludes in a phrase which does not quite avoid the charge of sounding condescending, he echoes the uneducated soldier's thoughts, he don't know why, whilst at the same time emphasising his bewilderment. So Sim described In the Pink as his first outspoken walk home, and could not have been all that surprised when the patriotic Westminster Gazette, it was one of the magazines of the day in London, he wasn't really surprised, probably, when he was not allowed to have it published there, on the grounds that it might prejudice recruiting. So Sim was on home leave from 15th of February to the 5th of March 1916, but by now deeply in love with a young subaltern, David Thomas, he was anxious to get back to France to protect him. And another of the unpublished poems at Cambridge, which I found to my delight, was another poem to David Thomas, Tommy, as he called him, and shows that his lyric impulse is still very much alive, though it seems increasingly like an attempt to escape rather than express war's realities. It's called simply Love. I find a clear blue morning in your looks, and youth who comes and goes yet never dies, in shoals of light that stream across the earth, and silver torrents flowing through the skies. The speedy gale is in your sudden laughter, and clustering bird notes from the stooping trees end with your silence. Filled with towering white clouds are your thoughts, and lovely is the breeze, very different from In the Pink. His grief and anger when Tommy was killed on the 18th of March, just over a month after this poem was written, helps to explain the distinct hardening of his attitude to the war in the months that followed. And this reveals itself in a deliberate attempt to shock. Stand to Good Friday Morning follows, and some of you will know it very well. Written, in fact, the day after Good Friday Morning, Stand to place ironically with the sacred connotations of the day of Christ's crucifixion, and the event it marks, and the soldier's blasphemous reaction to trench life. I'd been on duty from 2 till 4. I went and stared at the dugout door. Down in the frost, I heard them snore. Stand to. Somebody grunted and swore. Dawn was misty. The skies were still. Larks were singing, discordant shrill. They seemed happy, but I felt ill. Deep in water, I splashed my way up the trench to our bogged front line. Rain had fallen the whole damned night. Oh, Jesus, send me a wound today, and I'll believe in your bread and wine and get my bloody old sins washed white. But of course, it's meant to be completely shocking. So Sim uses his own experience directly here. He had indeed been on duty from 2 till 4 on Good Friday, the 21st of April, 1916, and had gone to rouse his platoon for Stand To, that's the early morning ritual when they have to stand to with their arms ready for action, and which was repeated also in the evening. Out of this jaunty scrap of doggerel, he himself noted, he made, I think, what is a very effective anti-war poem. The laconic tone is adopted deliberately to shock, since the sacredness of the day would lead us to expect something more reverent. In view of the day, the reader is also led to reflect on the ironic comparison and contrast between Christ hanging on the cross with his wounds literally bloody, and, of course, the soldier praying for a wound of Blighty, which would enable him to get back to England, known as Blighty, of course, which is why the wounds were known as Blighty. Something not too serious, just enough to send him home. During the 4 months which followed David Thomas's death in March 1916, Sassoon's mood still fluctuated wildly. His initial despair and resignation was closely followed by anger, an anger which increased his recklessness and made himself ready to kill and get killed. As the reality of his brother Hamo's loss grew on him, and first-hand experience of the trenches brought home the random destructiveness of war, his hatred of the Germans was redirected, and I think this is a very important aspect of Sassoon's war experience, redirected towards those in authority on his own side, the politicians, the army staff, and the yellow press journalists whom he began to hold responsible for the continuation of the war. I'm sure you know that he mingled with Lady Otterlin's pacifist group and was convinced that the British government could have made some kind of peace overture to the Germans before. Whether he was right or wrong, I'm not qualified to say, but it certainly explains his own anger. At the same time, and alternating curiously with such bitterness, he still had moods of almost mystical exaltation in which he longed to sacrifice himself for his country. Paradoxically, but of course not surprisingly, the greater he longed for death, the sweeter life seemed to him, and this produced other, more familiar moods of joy in nature. You get a lot of that in the poems. Once away from the trenches, for example, at an army training corps at Blixecourt in May, he could write lyrically in a poem called France that they are fortunate who fight for gleaming landscapes swept and shafted and crowned by cloud pavilions white, hearing such harmonies as might only from heaven be downward wafted, voices of victory and delight. Again, quite different from Good Friday, isn't it? The backdrop to the period, however, is the Battle of the Somme, with its long build-up as the Allies prepare to mount their most massive attack so far, an attack which had as one of its purposes to deflect the Germans from massacring the French at Verdun, of course. But the realities of war were never very far away, particularly when his dear bombing sergeant, and that's his name, his description, his dear bombing sergeant, Nick O'Brien, a large, genial Irishman, is killed in a preliminary raid on the 24th of June, 1916, a raid which the Colonel Stockwell, very tough man, and also Sassoon himself believed was not necessary. Though no poetry results from this episode, during which Sassoon earns his MC, and you've heard Max talk about that, for bringing in his corporal O'Brien and others under fire, under direct, he says, Christ, the Germans are firing down at me. He's in the trench. He's in one of the shell holes, and they're firing directly at him. And he does that, and he goes out again and again to bring the men in. His anger deepens, but despite this, there are occasional returns to the lyrical in poems like Before Battle, which I won't read you. As John H. Johnson, and I don't know whether you know his work, but I find him one of the most perceptive, although not one of the most fashionable nowadays, critics of the First World War, he points out in a very cogent argument that lyric poetry is very rarely adequate to express the grim reality of war. And for his money, he says only the epic poet like David Jones. Perhaps he would include Rosenberg. I think he does, because towards the end, Rosenberg is working towards an epic in poems like Daughters of War. But he says lyric poetry cannot really express the realities of war. And when Sassoon came fully face to face with war, as it was at the Somme, not on the first day of the Somme, when he was only an observer in support, it was a marvellous description of him watching everybody going across the top. Wonderful description of the first day of the Somme, and if we had time, we could have read it. But 3 days later, as he marched his men up to Mamet's Wood, it was not lyric or pastoral verse which followed from this experience. For the first time, as you've heard, he found himself among the debris of a fierce attack. Rags and shreds of bloody clothing, bullet-riddled boots and abandoned equipment. This both horrified and fascinated him, passing about 30 of the British dead laid out by the side of the road, and this is the quote you heard, their fingers mingled in blood-stained bunches. He reflected that these Gordon Highlanders, Devonshires, and South Staffordshires were finally beyond regimental rivalry in the companionship of death. As he reached the old German front line in his slow progress towards Manette, he was conscious of a sour, pervasive stench, which differed from anything he had previously experienced. And he discovered that it was the stench, the smell of corpses nearly 3 days old. Some of these strewed the communication trench out of Manette's, their badly mangled bodies deeply shocking in their distorted attitudes. Though he had been with the 1st Battalion in France for nearly 8 months, these were the first newly dead Germans he had seen. So it was Manette's wood, and it was one of the reasons I thought it would make a very good subject, really, for Sassoon. It is a turning point, as Max has already pointed out in his experience. Though the planned attack by 1st Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers was abortive, again, the 1st Royal Welsh Fusiliers Colonel Stockwell ordered the men back to camp when the reputedly empty wood turned out to be very much occupied, as you've heard. It did lead, though it was abortive, it did lead to one of Sassoon's most devastating poems. Now, Max has read you part of The Road, and it is the poem to come out of Manette's, and I hope you won't mind if I read you the whole. And what puzzled me about this poem to begin with was I thought, what were the women doing at Manette's Wood? But of course, the women are the women at home, thinking of their husbands, there in spirit, over looking over the men and the men themselves, dead. And here I think that lyric impulse is subsumed into something which also includes the realities of war. For me, for my money, it's Sassoon at his best when he manages to control the reality of the war, or to combine it, with the compassion that it arouses in him. Its account of the way up to Manette's Wood, while starkly realistic, reveals a more tender, less bitter side. And I think it makes this description almost unbearable in its frustrated compassion. The road is thronged with men. Sorry, can I start again? Exactly the wrong word. The road is thronged with women. Soldiers pass and halt but never see them. Yet they're here, a patient crowd along the sodden grass, silent, worn out with waiting, sick with fear. The road goes crawling up a long hillside, all ruts and stones and sludge, and the emptied dregs of battle thrown in heaps. Here where they died are stretched big-bellied horses with stiff legs, and dead men, bloody-fingered from the fight, stare up at cavern darkness waking white. You in the bomb-scorched kilt, poor sprawling jock, you tottered here and fell, and stumbled on, half-dazed for want of sleep. No dream would mock your reeling brain with comforts lost and gone. You did not feel her arms about your knees, her blind caress, her lips upon your head. Too tired for thoughts of home and love and ease, the road would serve you well enough for bed. Afterwards, in his diary, Sassoon said in 1929, in the first week of June, when he was copying out memoirs of an infantry officer, and you've heard a passage from there, and as he approached the story of Manette's Wood, he felt that to write about this was like mental penal servitude. So it obviously had a huge effect on him. It clearly made a very powerful impression. And it still figured prominently in a poem written 3 years after the war, Aftermath. The middle of its three stanzas is devoted solely to that cursed wood that you heard about. The only sector to be named in this poem. Interestingly. Do you remember the dark months you held the sector at Manette's? The nights you watched and wired and ducked and piled sandbags on parapets? Do you remember the rats and the stench of corpses rotting in front of the front line trench, and dawn coming dirty white and chill with the hopeless rain. Do you ever stop and ask, is it all going to happen again? It could be for the anti-war movement, that poem, don't you? One important reason that Manet's wood is so significant in Sassoon's development is that his satires, for which he's best known, may give the idea that he lacks compassion, because there are some very brutal things in those satires. Think of a poem like Blighters, for instance, where he longs for the tanks to come lurching down the stalls, presumably to kill all those people in the audience who are so unaware of what's going on in France. Mamet's wood, above all, shows how mistaken this impression is. All the poems inspired directly by events there show profound compassion and insight. Take Died of Wounds, for instance, written a fortnight after the wood was recaptured. You heard it was recaptured on the 12th of July. And this poem is written a fortnight afterwards, when Sassoon comes face to face with a victim of the fierce fighting there. Died of Wounds. His wet white face and miserable eyes brought nurses to him more than groans and sighs, but hoarse and low and rapid rose and fell his troubled voice. He did the business well. The ward grew dark, but he was still complaining and calling out for Dickie. Curse the wood. It's time to go. Oh, Christ, and what's the good? We'll never take it, and it's always raining. I wondered where he'd been, then heard him shout, they snipe like hell. Oh, Dickie, don't go out. I fell asleep. Next morning, he was dead, and some slight wound lay smiling on the bed. Of course, those army terms, a slight wound, is probably put down as an SW. Died of Wounds is DOW, and he's using that as a kind of mockery of how much that hides that language. His compassion was not just for soldiers on his own side. After Mamet's wood, it extended to the Germans too. Don't forget he saw his first newly dead Germans there. And you remember the story Max told you of him going up Quadrangle Trench and taking Wood Trench single-handedly. And although Max, I like Robert Graves' story, I'm afraid it has been proved to be apocryphal. He did not take out a book of poetry when he got there. Unfortunately, I love the idea. Sassoon was so dreamy, it would have been a lovely thing, wouldn't it? And you remember how he occupied it himself, and how on his way up, he propped the German up, the young German up, and on his way back, he found him trodden into the mud. And what I want to read you now, and I haven't really got much more to say, but I want you to realize just how strong an impact it had on him, is that I'm going to read you now a poem which was not published at the time, but perhaps because it spoke compassionately of the Germans, maybe it was too soon to publish it in 1918 in Counterattack. But the last 12 lines, which were never published, not even in Rupert Hart Davis's 1980 edition of War Poems, I think, 1983, I found them at the University of Austin in Texas. I lifted him, a lump of death, white mud from mouth and eyes and beardless cheek, and showed that sullen mask to the blank sky. I propped him safely up beside the trench till he looked tidy for a hostile corpse. But in the afternoon I passed and found him sprawling ungainly on his back, his face green and disfeatured, where a British boot had trod his skull deep into the grey ooze. Such is defeat. Not beautiful nor kind, and this was ugly death, a shameless thing stripped of its sable hood that cloaks his grin. So you can see this compassion is not just reserved for his own side. It was here that he felt at his most compassionate, yet most frustrated. And as he brooded on it during that convalescence in England from July 1916, when he went back to England with trench fever, and had that wonderful recuperation at Somerville College, Oxford. He and Graves loved the idea that they were convalescing at a woman's college, especially since Cecile was a homosexual. But as he convalesced, his bitterness actually increased. It didn't diminish. And the ugly wastage of war. It seems to have been at this point, after Mamet's Wood, that he began to feel that satire was his most effective way of convincing readers of his viewpoint. It's certainly during this period that he produced some of his most scorching condemnations of the war. The One-Legged Man, and you, all of you, I'm sure, be familiar with these poems. I want to read them all, but I'm not going to, you'll be relieved to hear them. Where a returned soldier rejoices in a rather macabre fashion in something normally regarded as a tragedy, losing a leg. Because, in his own words, it leaves him, quote, free to eat and sleep and choose a wife, safe with his wound, a citizen of life. Well, what a price. What a price. The Tombstone Maker, you may know, the Tombstone Maker, a particularly nasty example of a civilian profiteer who laments the deaths in France for a shockingly selfish reason. You'd think so much bereavement would have made unusual big demands upon my trade. The war comes true and hard on some poor folk. Unless the fighting stops, I'll soon be broke. Very shocking. The inadequacy of Christianity, of course, is addressed in a poem like They, where the bishop meets the boys, you know, and they say, well, we're none of us the same. Bert's got syphilitic, somebody else has lost a leg. And he says, the ways of God are strange. And the total inadequacy of that to deal with the situation, of course, doesn't need to be pointed further. The yellow press are criticised. Even women, generically, the glory of women, do not escape his scathing comments, and nor does the army itself, theoretically, part of those who suffer from the fighting. Of course, the top brass at home, in Sassoon's opinion, and in the opinion of many of the soldiers out there, had it easy, had it cushy. And if you read base details, you know what he means when this chap, well, perhaps he isn't at home, but he's certainly not in the line, and the Scarlet Major. Romy Ross had talked about Scarlet Majors, and you know that Scarlet, you notice the choice every year, the armistice suit. Scarlet, Scarlet on the lapels and Scarlet on the cap band to signify army staff. And, of course, the play on the Scarlet with sin, because of the deaths on his hands, according to Sassoon. Scarlet with high blood pressure from too much good food and wine, guzzling and gulping in the best hotel. And he puts into the mouth of this pottery old major some very shocking words. If I were fierce and bald and short of breath, I'd live with scarlet majors at the base and speed glum heroes up the line to death. You'd see me with my puffy, petulant face, guzzling and gulping in the best hotel, reading the Roll of Honour. Poor young chap, I'd say, I used to know his father well. Yes, we've lost heavily in this last scrap. When the war is done and youth stone dead, I'd travel safely home and die in bed. Even the army serving generals did not escape, and you all know I won't. Perhaps I won't. Will I? Shall I read the general? Are you going to indulge me? I don't want to send you to sleep. this, of course, is an incident based. I went to a Duckworth launch party on one occasion, and somebody came up to me, evidently not a literary part of Duckworth, and he said, what are you working on? And I said, well, I've done two volumes on Siegfried. Oh, I know Sassoon, he said. Good morning, good morning. I said, yes. And he recited it all the way through. Didn't look like a man who remembered poetry. Now, in this poem, of course, it's supposed to be based on him passing a general. We think it's General Maxey, do we? Yes. On his way up to Arras in early 1917. And it's savage, of course, in its portrayal of a leader apparently totally unconcerned about the fate he's sending his soldiers to. The admiration of one of these soldiers, Harry, who becomes a victim of the general's battle plan, emphasizes his callousness. You notice how Harry and Jack kind of personalizes the soldiers but also depersonalizes them because they're rather generic names, aren't they? Good morning, good morning, the general said when we met him last week on our way to the line. Now the soldiers he smiled at are most of them dead, and we're cursing his staff for incompetent swine. He's a cheery old card, grunted Harry to Jack as they slogged up to Arras with rifle and pack. But he did for them both with his plan of attack, And you know, of course, and I've said it before, I'm sure you know, that what he wrote originally was, but he murdered them both by his plan of attack. And Eddie Marsh, Winston Churchill's private secretary, said, my dear Siegfried, you cannot say that. And he didn't, but I actually think he did for them both. In its euphemism, is more effective. It was after the slaughter that Sassoon witnessed at Arras that he composed his famous public protest against the war, protesting on behalf of the men, risking a court-martial, possibly execution. Instead, of course, he was sent to Craig Lockett, where he met Wilfred Owen. I think he'll be talking about Wilfred Owen next year, if you all come. But I want to end with a poem, which for me is even more effective as an anti-war piece, where his savage satire is deepened by the compassion that I think he first really learnt at Mamet's Wood. Does it matter? Now, does it matter, and it really is the last of this lecture, so you can relax and enjoy the poem, and it was based on three scenarios. One, in which a man loses a limb, and Sassoon himself was a great huntsman, so for him, losing your leg would be worse. Although a friend who had just lost his arm, who was a professional pianist. The second verse, his great fear in the war of going blind, is put into this, imagining what it would be like to be blind. And thirdly, his experience at Craig Lockett Mental Hospital, when he talks about what happens when you lose your mind. And this, for me, is Sassoon at his best. Does it matter? Does it matter losing your legs? For people will always be kind, and you need not show that you mind when the others come in after hunting to gobble their muffins and eggs. Does it matter losing your sight? There's such splendid work for the blind, and people will always be kind as you sit on the terrace remembering and turning your face to the light. Do they matter, those dreams from the pit? You can drink and forget and be glad, and people won't say that you're mad, for they'll know you fought for your country, and no one will worry a bit. Thank you.